This is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The members of the House Committee on Energy and Commerce relived election night this week. Among the highlights of that hearing, Dan Rather's greatest hits.
Photostat it, underline it in red, press it in the book, put it in an album, hang it on the wall. George Bush is the next president of the United States.
No wonder they were yucking it up in the hearing room. Within 2 hours of Dan's pledge, CBS and four other networks had to spit it out, tear it up, erase the underline, remove it from the book, and take it off the wall as Al Gore unconceded the race.
The networks have been doing internal reviews ever since. The findings of those reviews? They screwed up. They screwed up because of bad data, because of misreading the bad data, and because everyone was so scared of being scooped by everyone else. On the other hand, the network said, no one would be that upset if it hadn't been an extremely close election. In other words, it only mattered because people were paying attention. Bob, you've been following this story, right?
Yeah, I guess, but not nearly as closely as Andrew Tyndall has been following this story. He publishes the Tyndall Report, a newsletter that analyzes network news and breaks down coverage into various statistical categories. In that capacity, Mr. Tyndall has watched every single evening newscast of the big three broadcast networks since 1988, including, of course, election night. His first observation is that no matter how egregious the network's errors, Congress needn't have gotten involved.
The networks made a mistake. They admitted they made a mistake. It didn't seem to be any business of the Congress whether they made a mistake or not.
Fox News President Roger Ailes didn't go that far, but he did object to being interrogated by an investigative committee versus a legislative fact-finding one and the swearing-in formality that went with it.
I am further disappointed that this committee views its role as adversarial, requiring us to take an oath as if we have something to hide. We do not.
Nonetheless, says subcommittee spokesman Ken Johnson, procedure demanded the oath be sworn.
I understand why Roger took it personally, but who would have been the first people to complain? Let's say during the Ford Firestone hearing last year, when we brought in Jock Nasser, and we said to Mr. Nasser, you know, we're going to give you a pass from swearing in, because his lawyers in the beginning did not want him to testify under oath because of the pending civil litigation all across the country. What if my boss, Billy Tozen, had said, Jack Nasser, we're going to give you a pass, we're not going to swear you in? Who'd have been the first one to burn us? It'd have been the networks, the nightly news. Roger Ailes would have led the charge. So I think it rang a little hollow.
We'll get to more of Johnson later. He personally played a key role in the hearings. Meanwhile, let's not dismiss Ailes' disgust at the swearing-in as a mere fit of pique. His characterization of the indignity may well reveal much more.
With or without a swearing-in photo op, we will hide nothing.
Oath as photo op. Why wouldn't he see it that way? Who can forget the image of tobacco executives lining up to swear, untruthfully, of course, that there was no credible evidence linking cigarettes to cancer? The footage was played on the news on 60 Minutes, eventually in a feature film about the news in 60 Minutes. It's exactly the enduring, indicting image these insiders understand it is best to avoid.
They had two audiences to play to. One was the public, who were the people who watched their newscasts, and the other was the congressmen themselves, who were their regulators. So they actually had to walk a fine line between playing to the country at large and playing to the people who can actually pass legislation against them.
And how did they walk that fine line successfully, in your judgment?
Yes, absolutely. They know how to do that.
Forgetting the First Amendment for a moment and putting aside rhetorical bluster about media arrogance, it's far-fetched to think that any politician would truly want to make enemies of the networks. You wouldn't expect the gentleman from North Carolina to take on tobacco or the gentleman from Nevada to stamp out gambling. Likewise, big media is an illogical target for the gentleman from, well, anywhere. As Indiana Republican Steve Bowyer observes, the relationship between lawmakers and TV networks is a symbiotic one.
Members themselves, when they have the opportunity to speak in front of cameras, they get a little excited and they want to pontificate.
So the men who run the government get all excited by the cameras. The men who run the cameras get all intimidated by the Congress. And where does that leave the news consumer?
That's exactly what I wanted to know from Garrick Utley, the CNN correspondent who's covered American elections and most everything else over a 40-year career. Garrick Utley, welcome to On the Media.
My pleasure.
So do you think there has been an erosion in trust in the network news coverage?
If you ask the public, as Gallup poll has asked, what they think of the networks in terms of high or very high levels of honesty and ethical standards, about 22% put network news and cable news in that category. If you ask how many consider journalists, broadcast journalists, to be average in their honesty and ethical standards, it's about 45 to 50%. So if you think average is at least a C+, it means about two-thirds of the American people give us average or above-average grades.
We wouldn't accept a politician with those grades, would we?
Well, actually, if you look at that same poll, it shows that broadcast journalists, TV reporters, and commentators come in just behind auto mechanics and just ahead of members of Congress. So I guess that answers that question.
Do you think a hearing like this gets us anywhere, or is it just a PR opportunity for both the networks and the politicians?
Well, it certainly wasn't a PR opportunity for the news organizations which were involved in the Florida calls last November. As far as members of Congress are concerned, yes, it serves to their advantage, or certain members of Congress who want to publicize this by holding this hearing, this inquiry or investigation, whatever you want to call it. But I think the most important aspect is that mistakes were made, and we've got to make darn sure it's not going to happen again, because you cannot commit that kind of an error before a nationwide audience and not pay some price for it.
You use that classic formulation, mistakes were made. Do you think that they're prizing speed now more over accuracy, and they're beginning to prize the sizzle over the steak? And can that be changed?
Well, I think you're talking about two different things here. Yes, the competitive pressures are going to be there. Journalists want to get the story first, but first, of course, we're supposed to get it right. And that's not going to go away. The competitive pressure will not disappear. But I think everybody, and I know this is going to happen at CNN, they're going to be much more careful about making these calls by setting down certain strictures on how they go about it. That is, if the results coming in are within 1%, we're not going to chance a call. We're going to wait until it's more clear-cut. And that's about the most you can really do.
Do you think this election night was a symbol of the fundamental shortcomings of the TV news business, or was it more of an anomaly?
Not at all. It's happened before. I've covered election nights in the studio at NBC. There's been at least one case, perhaps two, in which the calls in a particular state were incorrect and had to be changed. Now, in those cases, nobody remembers it because it didn't affect the outcome of the election.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
CNN newsman Garrick Utley is also the author of You Should Have Been Here Yesterday, A Life in Television News.
Assembled before Congress, men who run the most influential communication outlets the world has ever known, asking the questions, men who hold in the palms of their hands the licenses to those outlets. Who would win the shootout? The answer turned out to be a semi-anonymous aide to Committee Chairman Billy Tozen. Ken Johnson is the spokesman for Congressman Tozen and for the House Committee on Energy and Commerce. He was the man who edited the videotape that kicked off the proceedings. It got a lot of laughs and, from a few of the network bosses, no small amount of indignation.
I certainly hesitate to accuse Congress of misleading editing that distorted what had happened. That would be a dramatic role reversal.
Listen, I'd be the first to admire a good editing job, and that was a good editing job. No way about it.
Ken Johnson, thanks for joining us.
Not a problem, Bob. Glad to be with you.
So you had all of this raw tape at your disposal, and you got to edit network coverage to show to the network executives in front of the Congress. How sweet must that have been?
For someone who spent 20 years as a broadcast journalist and had many stories that I sent to the networks, edited down or killed, oh, how sweet the revenge was.
What was the purpose of the setup piece that you had before the hearings on Wednesday?
Well, in a nutshell, it was to try and visually remind people how chaotic election night was. Admittedly, we took hours and hours and hours of network coverage and cut it down to 10 minutes. But I will tell you, despite the fact that Mr. Hayward and others were not amused, it was a fair representation of the chaos of the moment, and nothing was taken out of sequence or nothing was taken out of context.
Yeah. I think I've heard that before from network executives.
I mean, hey, come
as
on. You think the network newscasts slant news stories?
All right, but concerning what the some of the executives complained about, they said that it created the impression, anyway, that the networks, all three of them, made election night look like just a romp for Al Gore, and that it suggested, in fact, that whatever chaos there was on election night redounded to the benefit of Gore and to the detriment of George W. Bush.
Well, this wasn't Fox. This wasn't simulated TV. This wasn't recreated TV. These were the words right from Tom Brokaw's mouth, right from Dan Rather's mouth, right from Peter Jennings' mouth.
Mm-hmm. But it's your point of view that the chaos, as it materialized on the air of the three networks, worked to the benefit of Gore and to the detriment of George W. Bush.
In some instances, not in all of them, but in some instances, clearly. Bottom line is the networks were all using bad data, which was provided them by VNS.
As you went through the hours and hours and hours of coverage on the three networks, did you find examples of careless coverage that would have benefited President Bush as opposed to then Vice President Gore?
The purpose of the exercise wasn't to show that the media tried to slant the election one way or the other. The purpose of the video was to show that at certain points in the evening, the networks didn't have a clue as to what was going on.
I'm just wondering if, as you went through all of the tape, you found material in there that would have benefited candidate Bush.
Yes, of course.
And, well, did that show up in
No.
your piece?
No, and I'll tell you why. And there were isolated incidents of that. But the reason they didn't is simply because the polls in America were closed at the time. And that's the whole point.
Fair enough. But still, I can't help being amused by the sort of the delicious irony.
We turned the tables on him.
Yeah, that's, I guess, what I'm saying. You turned the tables on him, didn't you, Ken?
And, you know, it was kind of fun to watch him squirm. You know, I would think, if nothing else, we ought to be able, at the end of the day, have a laugh about this and then move on.
Well, Ken Johnson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, we inaugurate our Pundit Watch and we critique our own Israel coverage.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, MSNBC found itself toggling between two graphics. One referred to congressional hearings in the Mark Rich case. It read, Pardon Watch.
The other, in reference to the less scandalous but still unbelievably well-documented issue of office space, said, Clinton Watch.
So we thought, what better time to institute a new ongoing On the Media feature, the Pundit Watch.
That's OTM's Pundit Watch, featuring our exclusive Punditron 2000.
Now, it takes a particular aligning of the planets to work the punditry into a froth this spumescent, but the Clinton post-presidency does the trick.
Combine an ex-president who's refused to relinquish the spotlight, a media who are all too glad to oblige, and a current president who doesn't mind a little less glare himself, And you've got guys like Chris Matthews on tilt.
What a story. So this is like primary colors. This is better than Clinton. This is Clinton in color, in technicolor. He's going up to Harlem because he really always wanted to go up there.
After Matthews stops playing hardball on MSNBC, on comes a show called The First 100 Days, hosted by esteemed cable host and disgraced newspaper columnist Mike Barnicle. What to talk about's a no-brainer. But who to have on as a guest?
Chris Matthews joins us now. Christopher, tell me, this guy is not just an amazing, amazing man.
Now that was a treat for MSNBC viewers. A full hour of Chris, followed by even more Chris, to keep them going before the CNBC reruns of Chris. But by no means was the media frenzy occurring only in Chris Matthews' mouth. Later on MSNBC, we heard from Lester Holt.
A far cry from Carnegie Towers. This is a very nice building, clean marble walls. There's a FedEx and the UPS drop-offs. There's a little lunchateria back there. You can grab a sandwich or some quick breakfast. But again, clean, nice building, one of the best buildings in Harlem, but a far cry from Carnegie Towers.
Fox News Channel isn't such a far cry from MSNBC, but it was there we discovered the assertion of the week. On the show called Hannity and Combs. Here's the Hannity part of that team commenting on Clinton's youthful recollections of flying into LaGuardia Airport from London before trekking up to Harlem.
I've done some investigative work today. In the years he's talking about, 68 and 70, LaGuardia Airport couldn't handle flights from London.
Stoke up the Punditron 2000. That's quite a provocative assertion, considering the obvious implication that President Clinton is a lying sack of shiftlessness.
Well, what do you know? Sean Hannity was correct. In the years 1968 to 1970, LaGuardia was not an international airport with direct flights to or from London. Connecting flights might have landed there, but Clinton was far more likely to have landed at nearby John F. Kennedy International. As for the inference we're expected to draw about Clintonian veracity versus simple confusion, the Punditron offers an exclusive electronic shrug.
There are some stories that journalists can't seem to report without bringing down an avalanche of criticism. Certainly, coverage of gun control and abortion inspires heated debate, but nothing like the rage that invariably follows stories about Israel. We have received letters asking us to look into American coverage of the Middle East, but for reasons that will soon be clear, this is a near impossibility. Instead, we invite you to examine the perspectives of the critics. What follows is a report from the ground that we regard as balanced and fair about the challenges faced by reporters in the disputed territories. Afterwards, we'll ask two critics for their reactions. First, our report on journalists caught in the middle from Rick Davis.
And don't let me take it down. Don't let me. And release.
Firm but gentle orders from a physical therapist at Jerusalem's Mount Scopus Hospital.
Stay.
Yola Monikoff lifts her leg, but not much. Her pelvis is shattered, nerve endings severed. On November 11th, this 26-year-old freelance photographer was in Bethlehem on her first assignment for the Associated Press. It was a fairly quiet day, she says. Young Palestinians were throwing a few rocks. The Israeli army responded with one tear gas round. Then an Israeli soldier came around the corner. The Palestinians ran. Yola ducked into a doorway.
I looked up, and there he was. He was about 50 meters away, and I saw that he was a soldier. I saw that he was wearing a helmet, and I saw that his gun was aimed at us.
And then the soldier fired.
I was screaming like a girl, and I wanted to let the soldier know that, hey, buddy, you made a mistake.
A mistake the Israeli army now admits. Standing orders were violated. A soldier can only fire live ammunition when he is in immediate mortal danger.
According to the army, there are two people to blame, two people who broke the rules of engagement, as they put it. An officer who first gave the order to shoot, which meant to shoot with live fire.
And the young man who fired the shot.
The soldier who shot me received an order to go shoot the Palestinian wearing the gray T-shirt and jeans. And I think was, you know, very scared and did a very shoddy job and just came out, you know, followed orders that were illegal.
Yola Monikoff calls the West Bank and Gaza the mean streets.
Yeah, I mean, I have a friend, an Israeli photographer, who caught a Palestinian bullet in his lens. So, of course, it's dangerous everywhere, and, you know, you never know where it's coming from.
Journalists are often caught in the middle on the many days when Israeli tank fire responds to Palestinian gunfire and the constant rain of rocks. The New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists has raised the question, are reporters being singled out as targets? Many believe they are. The Israeli army and the Palestinian Authority say no. But the committee has documented a long list of shootings, beatings, and harassment. Example, October 31st. CNN's Cairo bureau chief Ben Wiedemann was at the Gaza-Israeli border. It was a day of heavy fire. During a lull, Wiedemann was trying to take down a camera tripod. He was shot in the back. Mike Hanna is the Jerusalem bureau chief for CNN.
The bullet was found in the flak jacket when it was subjected to ballistics analysis back in the United States, and it was an Israeli bullet. The Israelis have apologized, if indeed they say they were responsible for the shooting. They insist that it was not intentional. I take their words on that particular element of trust, given the circumstances on that particular day.
There are other times there is little doubt that violent action is intentional. Example, Lee Hockstetter of the Washington Post. He wrote a story about the Israeli army's use of lethal force. It was at night. He was at home.
We heard a boom as we were preparing dinner. And unfortunately, these days, one hears booms in the evening in particular quite a bit. And so we thought nothing of it. As we sat down to dinner, noticed the fire engine, red lights flashing outside our living room window, went outside to see flames shooting up from our cars.
Now it seems more than ever in the Middle East, you will be on someone's bad guy list, maybe everyone's.
Feelings run so high that you simply cannot convince people that there is any such thing as an impartial, dispassionate observer. Everyone's convinced that if you're not with them, you're against them.
And that leads to attempts by both the Israelis and the Palestinians to control how a story is covered, and at times, prevent any coverage. Ramallah, a West Bank town, October 12th. Two Israeli soldiers were captured and taken to a Palestinian police station. A group of young Palestinians forced their way into the building. The police seemed to do little to stop them. The mangled body of one Israeli was thrown from the building. The other was lowered by rope. The killers leaned from a window, showing their bloody hands to a cheering crowd. There were many photographers there that day, most of them Palestinians. But the only images ever seen came from one Italian cameraman. Why only one? Nasser Atta, a Palestinian producer for ABC News, describes the day.
They stopped us physically by putting our cameras down. Some people, their cameras were taken from them, they were confiscated, and some were beaten to stop filming. The youth were so angry there, and they were out of control, actually, really out of control. I think we just said we will stop filming instead of us being beaten or stabbed or anything like this.
Mob rule is not the only thing Palestinian reporters face from their fellow Palestinians. Some have been arrested and jailed. Newspapers, radio, and television stations have been closed by the ruling Palestinian Authority. The dangers can be far greater for an Israeli journalist.
I do the coverage of the West Bank and Gaza since 67. I never remember such a time.
Danny Rubenstein is one of Israel's most acclaimed reporters, but he seldom goes to the West Bank or Gaza now, where no one believes any Israeli can be a neutral observer and anyone can be a spy.
And if you don't serve them, they look on you as their enemy. And also here, my people, if I write something that doesn't serve the interest of the Israeli government, they say, what are you doing? We are just state of war. So I would say, really, it's one of the most problematic period in my career as a journalist, no doubt about it.
And you've been at this a long time.
Yeah, since the war in 67, which means almost 34 years.
Many Israelis are convinced that the Western media are a tool in a propaganda war, and Major Yardin Vatakai, the foreign press officer for the Israeli army, says the Palestinians are winning that war.
I believe that since the very beginning, everything that they organized was with the vision to be covered and to be viewed by all the world. Their image of this conflict managing bitterness, managing to control the press and the products of the press more than us.
But Paul Adams of the British Broadcasting Corporation says when it comes to propaganda, the Israelis win hands down.
The Palestinians remain hopeless at it, which comes as a surprise to Israelis who believe that there's a very slick Palestinian propaganda operation going on. There simply isn't.
And Adams says it's Israel and its supporters that are running a propaganda campaign with letters of protest and email messages. An example, his BBC crew was pushed around and punched a couple of times in a confrontation with Palestinians. Adams says it was too insignificant to report, but...
Before I knew it, the BBC in London was receiving dozens of email messages accusing the BBC of covering up a brutal assault on a BBC crew by Palestinian officials. It all came from an organization in the States, pro-Israel right-wing organization that monitors media coverage of the Middle East. They had encouraged their supporters to send these messages, and in due course they all came sounding all rather similar.
Mike Hanna of CNN says you have to get used to it.
We have criticism from the Israeli government. We have criticism from the Palestinians. A lot of the time their job is propaganda. Our job is news. They are two sides that actually don't coexist very happily.
Push, push me, push, up, 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 and release.
Yola Monikoff is just one journalist who may have been caught in that unhappy coexistence. She faces months, perhaps years of therapy to repair a body shattered by a gunshot.
Stay, stay, stay.
So after all this, do you think you chose the right profession?
Yeah, I chose the right profession. I mean, you have to do what you have to record events that happen, I think. But of course, I'll have more regrets if my foot doesn't start working than if it does.
For On the Media, I'm Rick Davis.
Gary Rosenblatt is editor and publisher of Jewish Week. Welcome, Mr. Rosenblatt.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you. And also Rashid Khalidi, who is director of the Center of International Studies and a professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Chicago. Thank you very much for being here.
It's a pleasure.
What we're particularly interested in this interview is to hear how this piece that you just heard sounded to your different ears. Do you think this piece conveyed, if not a complete picture, at least a realistic picture of the issues that journalists face on the ground? Mr. Rosenblatt.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of levels here. Certainly on one level, there was a give and take, and there's a certain symmetry here. The problem, which is a deeper level, is a kind of media focus and sometimes obsession with symmetry. Palestinians lynched two Israelis, and later that day, Israel retaliates by firing rockets on a building after alerting the neighborhood, and so there are no casualties. So the next day, it's reported Palestinians did X, and Israel retaliates with Y. But I think what's missing is a kind of moral relativism. These are not equal incidents of violence, and sometimes they're reported that way.
Strangely enough, I find myself in agreement. I think that what is missing, especially from American media coverage, I thought it was a good piece, but what's missing from American media coverage is a historical and analytical framework. I mean, Israelis are being killed in occupied territory. That has to be driven home or you're not telling the truth. The day-to-day brutality, violence of the occupation is never set against whatever violence, quote-unquote, stone-throwing kids or snipers are using against occupation soldiers and settlers who are there in violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. Just to use terms like the Fourth Geneva Convention means we're talking about a level of analysis which this piece and most, frankly, most journalism doesn't address. I'm not just talking about moral relativism. I'm talking about context and background, the kind of thing that you get in much of the coverage in, say, the Israeli press or the European press or the Arab press, unfortunately, tends to be missing.
Well, I'll agree with the professor in terms of the need for analytical and contextual, focus on these issues. When people start talking about Geneva Conventions and Resolution 242 and 338 and the Balfour Declaration, you can sense people's eyes glazing over. And that's part of the general problem, I think, we have with people wanting very short news bites and just wanting headlines rather than context.
I'd like to bring in the reporter now, Rick Davis, who has been listening to this discussion. Welcome again.
Thank you.
Now, you've heard from both Mr. Rosenblatt and from Mr. Khalidi that there were critical things missing from your report. How would you address that?
I would say they're both right when it comes from the lack of historical and analytical coverage in the story and in the Middle East itself, particularly in the American news media. And I have covered the Middle East for a long time, and I think we have always been in error in doing that.
Why don't you address the practical considerations of covering the Middle East, then? Obviously, most news holes don't allow for a story even a third as big as the one you just produced for us. So how can one cover it if one has to go over the historical ground every single time?
That's always been the problem in the Middle East, just as it was the problem in Bosnia. Every time you had to go through it, you seemed to have to start at phase one. But the problem is that everybody has a different view of phase one. What is the history of the Middle East? What are the causes of what's going on there? You're never going to find a way of answering that question.
And so then the question is it possible for any reporter to cover the Middle East to the satisfaction of Mr. Rosenblatt and Mr. Khalidi and Mr. Davis? Mr. Khalidi?
I wouldn't give advice to a veteran like Rick. What I would say is, you know, pay attention to two big problems that are structural. One is the nature of the medium, how hard it is to get a long, detailed piece across. And the second thing is to deal with the prejudices back home of the editors, producers, and people who don't know anything about anything. They have strong feelings, but they've never been there, and they don't know anything. They have sympathies, though, most of them for Israel. And there's no countervailing force. I mean, we don't have the Arab American community and the Muslim American community haven't developed to the point where they've thrown up the dozens and dozens of people who've done journalism and have reached that stage. In 30 or 40 years, you wouldn't be able to make this complaint. 50 years ago, you wouldn't have had anybody who was Jewish in those positions.
Well, curiously, our readers would say that, you know, everything the professor said was true, except that the bias that's coming from the editors is not a pro-Israel bias, but rather a pro-Palestinian bias.
Rick, do you have one more comment?
No, except my agreement that they're both right. It's one of the few times I must have been criticized for covering two sides of the story.
You chose a hard row to hoe, what can I say?
I want to thank you both for being here. Gary Rosenblatt, editor and publisher of The Jewish Week, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Rashid Khalidi, who is the director of the Center of International Studies and a professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Chicago, thank you too.
You're welcome.
Please send us your reaction to this or anything else you hear to On the Media, that's one word, On the Media, at WNYC.org.
Coming up, Lynn Cheney versus Eminem, Hollywood versus Hardcore, and Ogres versus Wood Elves.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The big-time rapper Marshall Mathers, known as Eminem, is up for 4 awards at the Grammys next week. The superstar has enraged people across the political spectrum with violent, homophobic, and misogynist lyrics. He says he means these things ironically, and that's how his young fans in the main take it. But his critics aren't convinced. Lynn Cheney, wife of the vice president, is one of his most prominent critics. Ms. Cheney, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Now then, you testified before Congress last fall, naming names. Public enemy number one seems to be Eminem.
What precisely do you suppose we should do about Eminem?
That's the difficulty, isn't it? One of the things that's most distressing about this situation is that his lyrics are so misogynistic, so homophobic, that there are actually people out there talking about government regulation, which, in my view, it would completely run afoul of the First Amendment. I think that the proper thing to do is for people to stand up and point to the corporate executives who are distributing this music, for people to simply say, so that kids understand, that this is not what our culture is about.
Last year, when Eminem collected his MTV award, he thanked his critics, presumably including you, for fanning the flames of controversy that gave him all of the publicity that he got, and for making him an anti-establishment martyr. Aren't you, by criticizing him, in effect becoming his number one publicist?
Even if that were true, it would still be important to speak out against this. You know, I don't even care if Eminem makes another $1 million because I spoke out. I want it to be clear that this is wrong.
But what if his albums that you subject to wind up in the hands of a million more kids who are egged on by the adult establishment criticism of him?
Well, you know what I hope.
Isn't that the mechanism?
Well, there's another mechanism that should be at work here, and of course that's parent responsibility. One of the things that is dismaying, if you read about some of the violence that's going on in our society, some of the really horrendous acts of violence that you see in the newspapers, the stabbing that occurred at the movie, was it Valentine Day? I believe that was the name of the movie, just in the last week or so. These were underage kids, you know, they're like 11 years old, and they're in a movie that's R-rated.
Okay. We're saying that Eminem is simply the end. It's beyond the pale. This is more than we can bear.
That's true.
But the same was said about Frank Zappa. The same was said about the Beatles. The same was said before the Beatles about Elvis Presley. The same was said about Benny Goodman. Isn't this just part of the process, the adolescent process, of rejecting their parents' values, if only temporarily, assert themselves as individuals?
There was, of course, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. You know, there was a drug overtone to some of the Beatles' music, though not all of it. But they were never advocating raping and killing women. This really does take us to a new frontier. And in a way, I'm sorry that you and I are spending our time talking about the worst stuff. American culture is capable of producing some really terrific stuff. You know, Paul Simon has a new album out that's wonderful. Faith Hill's Breathe, U2, Beautiful Day.
In the Washington Post, a columnist named Gene Weingarten had a novel solution that actually sounds quite plausible to me. He believes that to fight the Eminem menace and to fight the culture wars at the front, what parents should do is flock to Eminem concerts and buy all the albums themselves and make him, therefore, so déclassé among the teenagers who don't want anything to do with what their parents embrace that he will simply disappear from the pop culture landscape.
You know, I get the point, but you remember Daniel Patrick Moynihan's formulation defining deviancy downward, you know, that we accept more and more. And I just do think there's some place we need to draw the line.
All right. Lynn Cheney, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Mainstream entertainment has always skirted the edges of the outrageous and the unacceptable. Author John Lewis says the film business may have actually profited from the actions of the censors. His new book, Hollywood vs. Hardcore, contends that Hollywood has happily muzzled itself for more than half a century to protect its bottom line. Mr. Lewis, welcome. Your tale, taken chronologically, actually begins 60 years ago with the House Un-American Activities Committee. Why start your story there?
Well, a couple of things are happening in 1947. One is the blacklist. Another is a well-predicted box office decline. Also happening at the same time are the emerging unions, which are becoming very powerful in Hollywood in the early 1940s. What the blacklist allows them to do is to regulate their workforce, to basically blacklist people by simply labeling them as communists.
So HUAC set the scene then for censorship. When does censorship of sexual content enter the picture?
Well, there had been censorship of sexual content since the 1930s with the Production Code Administration. But in the 1950s, the U.S. Supreme Court has a series of decisions that allow for a wider range of material in films and also allow theaters to show a wider range of material without local censors stopping them. The studios start releasing films like Tien's Sympathy, Baby Doll, eventually in the 60s, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which clearly defy the original production code. And it becomes necessary on the part of the studios to develop a new system that would accommodate their own membership. And that new system is the Motion Picture Association of America rating system that we have in effect today, which allowed R-rated films. So there was nudity and there was violence and there was explicit language.
Set the scene for us. During the Nixon administration, what were the big selling films in 1972?
Well, the biggest film in 1972 was Godfather, and it seemed to usher in a kind of new era in American film, what was called the auteur era. And on the other hand, you have a whole group of hardcore films that are doing incredibly well at the box office, films like Deep Throat, which is the most famous of them, Behind the Green Door, and actually the film that did the best at the box office, The Devil and Miss Jones. And what I think surprised the studios was that once the market got open, completely open and unregulated, everybody in America seemed to want to go see these hardcore films.
And the studio responded how?
Well, by panic. That's how they respond to everything. On the one hand, they knew they couldn't make these kinds of films, being the kinds of corporations that they were. But at the same time, they risked losing the audience forever to these hardcore films. And what happened was, of all people, Richard Nixon, who was on the House Committee on Un-American Activities back in the late 40s, basically made it very difficult to show a porn film in a public theater. Because if your community, based on its unique community standards, objected to the material in your film and could deem it obscene, that Supreme Court would basically uphold that decision. And the result was that overnight, films like Deep Throat, Devil and Miss Jones, and Behind the Green Door were isolated in just single theaters in so-called bad neighborhoods of big cities instead of just playing everywhere. And by the end of the 70s, the studios have the entire marketplace to themselves. And they have the rating system, and luckily enough, Richard Nixon to thank for that.
And so that is how the struggle over censorship saved the modern film industry, as you described.
Yeah, I suppose in a nutshell that's true. There's a famous saying in Hollywood that when they say it's not about the money, it's about the money. And that's what censorship's all about. It's never about morality. It's always about money.
Mr. Lewis, thank you very much for talking to us.
Well, thank you.
As Wall Street bemoans the meager returns from internet commerce, it's worth noting that there is a way to make a profit in cyberspace. I mean, besides pornography. Like pornography, it's said to be addictive and it can consume vast quantities of time. It can strain marriages, and devotees sometimes acquire the unwholesome pallor of a life spent indoors. It's called online gaming.
The most popular form of which is the role-playing game. Right now, with 330,000 subscribers and revenues of at least $60 million, the goldmine role-playing game is EverQuest. It teems with gods and monsters and with humans. Up to 80,000 of them have been known to play the game simultaneously. To enter the game, you have to craft a character.
So you're going to help me pick my character for EverQuest?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's the box.
She looks like Barbie meets I Dream of Jeannie, and she's embossed.
Stop feeling her. Okay, these are all the races I get to choose from. Barbarian, dark elf, dwarf, erudite, gnome, half-elf, halfling, high elf, human, Ixar, which is a lizard, ogre, troll, and wood elf. So, what do you think?
Well, you know, I hate to say half elf. I'd prefer to say half people of small stature. But
recently, an EverQuest convention convened outside Baltimore, Maryland. What is your name?
My in-game name is Bregolad. I'm wearing chainmail. This chainmail, I made it all myself, so...
It's amazing.
Yeah, thank you. It's kind of out of character because I'm actually an enchanter, spellcaster.
Someone, actually it was an EverQuest PR rep, told me, a moment enjoyed is a moment not wasted. And by that measure, these people, well over 1,000 of them, waste not.
Oh, it's a blast. We do it constantly. I'm a 53 wizard. My husband is a 53 shaman. My friends here are 53 clerics and warriors.
What's the difference between a 53 and a 52?
I got some more spells where I can do more damage.
EverQuest subscribers pay about $40 for the CD-ROM and then about $10 a month to play. And boy, do they, spending an average of 20 hours a week logged into EverQuest. Actually, that was low for most of the conventioneers I talked to, but not for Dave.
How often do you play?
Probably about a good 20 to 30 hours a week. Not as bad as some here. They'll put in about 40, 50 hours a week. You know, that's like having a second job.
What's the attraction?
You get to be whatever you choose to be. I mean, this is still basically a crude game compared to what's going to come out. In 5 years, this will be mainstream.
And does that mean that more and more people won't have a life outside of a job in EverQuest?
Well, you see, that's an interesting thought. Technically, if nobody here has a life, and yet you've got 1,200 people in the room, and they're all having a great conversation, and they're all sharing something in common.
Do you ever worry, Dave, about the addiction? They've called it EverCrack, stuff like that.
It's a great standing joke. I still dare them to challenge that conviction to TV. At least here, you're interacting with people. It's like, you know, you have big conventions of football fans get together.
But they don't watch football 30 hours a week.
Not if they don't have the ability to. They only lack the ability. If you gave them the capability to watch football 30 hours a week, you know there would be couch potatoes there watching 30 hours a week. Some people are pretty scary.
It should be noted that Dave was in leather mask, horns, and a furry cape.
Once we set it in motion, it was in a lot of ways no longer our own game.
Jeff Zotkin is one of the principal designers of EverQuest, which borrows heavily, he says, from J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, with a little George Lucas thrown in.
Wizards, sorcerers, and enchanters mastered powerful magic and mystical arts.
Being a 3D kind of world, you'll walk through a fantasy city, and it's like you're looking through your character's eyes, and hundreds of other people will all walk by you. They're all real people playing from different places. If your character waved his hand, the 20 people who are like immediately next to you would all see the character wave his hand. You realize you're not playing versus just a computer anymore, that you're playing with all of these other real people.
So you're the woman on the box.
Yes, I am. I'm actually the model that posed for the painting, so it's kind of a double fun thing. They actually get to see, you know, me.
She has the pointed ears of an elf, but the body and sartorial sense of Britney Spears.
Does it ever worry you? I mean, there are a number of adolescent boys at this convention, and I have no doubt that some of them have, at some point or the other, had thoughts about your image on that box.
Yes, I'm sure of that. doesn't bother me. No. If they get enjoyment out of my picture, you know, more power to them, as long as they don't try and put their hands on me.
90% of EverQuest subscribers are male, but only about 70% of the characters they play are. One gamer told me that if you play as a girl, you tend to get stuff from other players. When the new player logs in for the first time, he must choose a gender, face, body, profession, and race. By race, we mean elf or troll or gnome, out of a limited selection before entering his home city, determined by race. Computer-generated characters or other real players may approach him as he learns to maneuver, find provisions, hook up with others of similar disposition, and go on quests. At the convention, EverQuestrians were offered a real-life quest.
Now I give you this sacred trust. Seek the pixie with pixie dust. Seek the pixie with pixie dust, my friend.
Michelle.
Hail.
Hail, traveler. I need little shiny things.
What kind of shiny things?
Little coins.
I will be back with 2 coins.
Little shiny things, pixie dust, objects are powerful in this game, and acquiring stuff is key to an EverQuestrian's progress. Over time, a gamer's character will acquire not just experience points and currency, but mighty accessories, all of which you can buy on eBay, despite the best efforts of EverQuest's owner, Sony. 282 EverQuest items were posted on eBay this week, including a necklace of superiority for $500 and a Deathbringer's rod for $152. But you can also buy the characters themselves. This week, a level 55 monk, if he were a car you'd call him fully loaded, was priced at $800. That means the seller was looking to unload a character he spent hundreds of hours to make wealthy and powerful. The gamer who created that 55-level monk may be running a lucrative side business in character building, or he may have decided, at long last, to log out. EverQuest has taken credit for creating some real-life marriages. It's also taken the blame for breaking up a few. Rich Young almost lost his girlfriend over a game some critics and fans call Never Rest.
At one point, I was playing it almost 8 to 12 hours a day, nonstop. On the weekends, if I wasn't sleeping, I was playing.
He's cut back, but he's still at it about 30 hours a week. After all, it's the place where everybody knows your online name, though he wouldn't tell me what it is.
I think the big trap is the social aspect of it. It's like, you know, you ever watch Cheers? The guy walks in. Norm, you know, everyone screams out his name. It's kind of like that. When you log in and you say, how's it going, everybody? All of your friends, everyone that's in your guild says, hi, what's up, how you doing?
Rich Young was forced to concede that the pleasures of a place like EverQuest can't be transferred to the world of flesh and blood. They can only distract us from it.
I got to the point where I was burning out. I was starting to lose a little bit of perspective. I realized, hey, wait a minute. This is not the path to absolution.
EverQuest designer Jeff Zotkin loves to hike in the real world, but when he's too busy, he enjoys trekking the ever-changing landscapes of EverQuest. The goal of any designer, he says, is to push virtual reality closer and closer to the real thing.
With better technology, you'll see better immersion. You'll see hooking up speech so that you'll actually talk into a little microphone. And probably 5 or 10 years after that, you'll start seeing the virtual reality in there. Very much like the holodeck from Star Trek, so that if they wanted to pop into a virtual bar and just go meet virtual people, they could. If they wanted to go drive a sports car in the Indy 500, they could. A custom-designed world.
The real world being what it is, it's inevitable that a safe and satisfying virtual world may be irresistible to some.
And that's always going to be a danger, that as we get better and better technology, people might decide that a created world is better than a real world.
And that danger is by no means limited to online media. Last Thursday, the Post Wire Service reported that a man in Melbourne, Australia, just married his television set. Incidentally, it was also made by Sony.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by George Edwards with Steve Sayarto, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Kira Deppenbrock, David Surchuk, Dylan Keefe, and Kathleen Horan.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Funding for On the Media is made possible by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bydale Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio, New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.